Welcome to Season 2 of Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with experts in disability about their journey, life, and inspiration.
I'm Sam Prue.
And I'm Nikki Nolan.
Let's get started.
Do you mind introducing yourself?
Drew Harima. My pronouns are he and him. And I have blue eyes, light brown hair and beard, wearing metal glasses with headphones and green hoodie with green t-shirt.
Now that we know sort of who you are, what are you up to these days in kind of accessibility?
Right now, I'm the UX accessibility intern at Kobo, working on the design team.
Nice. Sounds like kind of vaguely more in the realms of the things that you do.
Yeah.
So it seems like you're right now, I think you said you're kind of just getting started on that kind of career path around design and around UX. Is this kind of the thing that you've always been doing, or is this a new path in life for you? And if so, what were you up to before that?
I originally went to school for American Sign Language, and because it was very visual, and I figured that would be a good fit for me, mm-hmm. until I realized that fingerspelling involves a lot of working memory. So after a year of that, I went to school for industrial design, and really loved that, and it fit my skills perfectly because throughout my life, I've struggled with school. But then after graduating, I wasn't able to get work because of my ADHD and dyslexia, because I was trying to, without a portfolio, it's really hard to get design work. And I was struggling with writing portfolio. Mm-hmm. So I was in this limbo of not being able to get design work and not being able to get experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody wants 5 years experience, right?
That's a bigger issue. But just like without any like proof of what I can do, no one would take a chance. And then, so eventually I got, and so the entire time I was trying to hide my ADHD and dyslexia, which wasn't helping. So eventually I started leading with it and started networking, trying to network past the issue of the portfolio. And I made a lot of connections, and a lot of people wanted to help, but there's not much you can do. There's no advice on how to get past the hiring process. And even some people told me to like just design my way through it. And that's really frustrating, because you're just trying to, like, you're giving people with disabilities more work to do instead of trying to solve the actual problem.
Uh-huh.
And so eventually I was found the position for UX accessibility intern. And that was a perfect fit, because it was part accessibility, part design. And with Wendy, my manager, they've been my biggest accommodation at work, because they understand. So that is like how I got into a design position. And after that, I realized how much I wanted to fix the whole design process. And since then, I've been basically trying to work on learning more about HR and what are the problems that can be fixed and what are the problems that can't be fixed.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because not to plug myself, but at a time of recording, I'm just fresh off last week giving an hour-long presentation on kind of the employment gap and the holistic problem that needs to be solved. And I mean, first of all, you got in, you got the break, you got the start, you got the position, and that's amazing. Was that through an especially great hiring process, or was that through, I think, an experience that is very common to people with disabilities, in that you know someone or you network and you finally get one person who's willing to give you a chance?
There's been three companies I ran into that when I asked for accommodations while applying, the HR responded and clarified what I needed. And Kobo was the third one. Accenture was the second one. I forget the first. But like, they actually asked what I wanted. So my accommodation requests were questions in advance and an alternative way to demonstrate my skills without a portfolio. And so with those two things, I was able to demonstrate that I had the skills, and was able to, with the questions in advance, I was able to connect what they were asking for with past experience.
Mm. So, I mean, it sounds like you finally found some HR processes that were sort of functional for you as a person with a disability.
I don't know how much that was at Wendy or how much that was Kobo. So it's hard to like really say.
Yeah.
And it's also with my next position, will that be the case?
Yeah. It's always frightening, isn't it, when you think about the job searches as a person with a disability. And so I'm interested in your thinking about the problems with HR, because it's something I've been thinking a lot about. And so, I mean, I know you probably don't have fully thought out solutions or fully thought out answers yet, because these are hard problems and these are difficult problems that we're all thinking about. But I'm interested to hear the directions that your thoughts are tending in. What are the big problems in HR, and what do you think is the wins and is fixable?
The overall answer is options. The more options you add into the hiring process, the better, because not everyone is willing to disclose. Not everyone knows they should disclose. So the more options you have, the less time people need to ask for accommodations. So if questions in advance are provided, then people don't have to ask for them. So people don't have to disclose, so people feel comfortable. If you have alternate ways of doing interviews, then you have that one less reason for discrimination. If you have, for developers, multiple ways or multiple options to demonstrate your developing skills instead of just whiteboarding, which is the most stressful way to demonstrate your skills as a developer, then people can choose what works for them as opposed to having to disclose. Because a lot of people who are neurodivergent don't realize it. And so they don't know why they're struggling, but if they have different options, they can pick what will work for them. So even if they don't know they need it, they don't have to ask for it.
Yeah, it's really the curb cut effect, like where that curb cut helped people who were disabled, but it also helped so many other people, just giving people those sort of variety of options. I think Sam, were you going to say something?
I was just thinking and thinking over sort of what you were saying about options and about accommodations. And it was interesting to me that you said, you know, people don't know that they should disclose. And I think disclosure of disability, right, is a really interesting thing that we all struggle with, right? Do you disclose up front? Do you disclose a little bit later? What are your thoughts and feelings about, like, when and why to disclose and how? Because that can be really scary for some folks.
Yeah, the advice is always, it depends. And that's the frustrating thing, is it depends on who you are. It depends on who they are. Like playing poker with someone, but they're holding all the cards. Like they know how they're going to react to you asking for accommodations, but you don't know how they're going to react. And if you don't know what's being tested, you don't know what you need to, if you need to ask for accommodations or not. One interview I had where I was given a paper printout to look for errors, and without spell check, that wasn't going to work for me.
Yeah.
So, and no one's going to be, you're not going to get printouts for checking errors. So this, I mean, it's obviously not a realistic expectation. So it's the test is disconnected from the actual work, which is another huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, some of these tests are like so fake and so artificial. And I never really dived in here because it's something that super interests me. And it sounds like it interests you too. But what is the thing that lights a fire in you when you what gets you out of bed in the morning and gets you passionate to do what you do? Maybe it is HR, but also maybe it isn't.
It started with being a designer, but not being able to design, and seeing all the bad design out there, like all the different bad text-to-speech options that don't work for me, but not being able to like have any input on them.
And so it sounds like what you're kind of like your why, your goal is to maybe bring more flexibility and options, maybe not just in HR, but in kind of life, right?
Like, yeah. But like you need people with disabilities and other minorities to get into work. We get to actually the positions where you're making the decisions in order for everyone to have representation. Mm-hmm. And it's not about it's not about me getting in there. It's about everyone, because I have, my perspective is of white, male, cisgender. And that's a very narrow perspective considering everyone's needs.
Yeah. Same. Diverse teams build diverse products, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are some of the key moments that like led you to this place?
It was struggling with trying to find work. So struggling with education and loving learning, but hating books. And so if you hate books and hate writing, then it's hard to see yourself in higher education. So after high school, I just struggled with trying to find something that worked for me and didn't. And then eventually decided to go to school for American Sign Language. And when that didn't work, decided to go to school for industrial design. Mm-hmm. And the frustration being good at design, but not being able to do it, that kind of like just like built up into something needs to change.
I'm really curious Does the school provide accommodations? Did you find a school that has like really good disability services? Because that's why I chose the school I went to. I specifically chose my undergraduate school because they had a good disability services department. And like every accommodation I asked for, they were like, yes. And it was heaven for me. I was just curious, did your school have anything like that?
It wasn't what I needed enough. It wasn't everything I needed. I don't know if it was better than worse than other options. So it was extra time on tests and Kurzweil. So books on through Kurzweil.
Oh, through Kurzweil. Mine were books, like people recorded them with their mouths because I can't do technology-based reading because my brain can't process it. I have to go through someone else's brain for me to, I don't know why. That's like my accommodation. I need it to be read by a person. So I had double time on test and then orally given, like they read the test and people would fill in the bubble sheets for me because I have this thing where circles freak me out. Yeah, so it was really helpful that I had that in undergrad. I think I wouldn't have been able to get through it if they hadn't provided those accommodations. But then when I got to grad school, it was so bad that like I just like gave up on trying to get accommodations. It's like really hit and miss between the schools.
Yeah, so it's, I feel like everyone who went through school and like went, got as far as they did, if they had the accommodations, would be so much further just because how inefficient accommodations usually are.
Mm-hmm. Is there, and I'm going to say something very, very controversial that you both might disagree with, and that's totally fine. One of the things that I notice in my own life is that I went to school for journalism and I don't use that at all in my work. And the reason I went to school is because there's so much pressure on us as people with disabilities, like, oh, well, if you don't get a university education to overcome your disadvantages, you're never going to be anything. And I wonder sometimes if that's fair, right? Like, I wonder if you would, if there was some program where you could just do design as opposed to being in school doing theory all the time, right?
Sam, you're like baiting me because you know I have another podcast about student debt. So
I'm just interested in both your thoughts on it.
No, I'm curious what Drew's thoughts are, but I definitely have a lot of thoughts.
Well, yeah, it's for me, learning through doing would have been better. But I never had the, you got to go to school in order to, like, it wasn't because of, like, it was more of a generational thing as opposed to a disability thing. So
can you explain that a little? What do you mean generational versus?
I felt like it'd be better. I have a better opportunities with school, but like the time when I graduated, so I graduated in 2003 and I went to start ACL in 2012. So it's not that I didn't, it wasn't that I went straight from high school to school. There's a huge gap there of me struggling to find something that worked. So it was more just like, I don't feel like there's like a, you need to go to school because your disability to do something. It's, but like, had there been an option of more hands-on learning, that would have been much better.
I have found that with other people, they get pressured into going to school because they're told that if they go to school, they'll be able to overcome all the hurdles and the boundaries that have been set up, you know, by society and stuff like that, and will help them excel. And then they get to school, graduate, and that was just a false promise. They just end up being a hole in a lot of student debt. And so I do think there needs to be different systems. The current education system seems to be failing, but it's like set up to fail. Honestly, it just seems like it's a money laundering scheme.
Right. Like, I mean, the thing that I learned in school was how to advocate for myself and how to get all these accommodations and how to identify as a person with a disability and how to talk about that and how to do that and how to be that, because like in high school, at least in my experience, you have your parents or other folks helping you, whereas in university you don't. But like maybe I could have learned that in the workplace, right? And not at the debt. I don't know, right? Like Drew, okay. I mean, there's a learning process there, right? Now you seem to have a pretty good idea of what accommodations you want and what accommodations you need and how to advocate for them. But there's a real learning process there. And like, what was that like for you?
The first thing I did when I got accepted to OCAD was contact the Students with Disability office. But that was like the extent of like advocating for myself really. And I don't think it was until I started applying for jobs while asking for accommodations, either in like the form or like as a cover letter, that I actually call myself or like identified as someone with a disability. So like throughout up until then, it was always, I would just hide my neurodivergence because it never seemed like it would just been like instant discrimination. So it wasn't until I gave up trying to hide it that I actually recognized that I am someone with a disability and that it's not me that's broken, it's the system.
Was there a particular moment that crystallized that for you where you thought, oh, I'm a person with a disability and I don't need to be ashamed of that or to hide that, and it's time to embrace it and to put it up front and to put it out there and to be my true self?
It was along the process of trying to network into a position and like writing comments and posts about accessibility on LinkedIn that it was somewhere in that it was some sort of transmit. I'm not sure it is an exact moment, but it was somewhere in there. So it's all been very recent.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I know you noticed that you went to OCAD, full disclosure, the place where I work. We've got a lot of OCAD connections. Both of our founders went to OCAD, and we've been privileged to do a number of things with you to Trevor Annis. Have you worked with her at all? I'm just curious for my own sort of interest. And it seems like the OCAD program worked for you. Was it because the accommodations were excellent, or was it because design is just your thing?
It's because design was my thing. Like, I don't think that, like, the accommodations kind of helped, but not really. And it was basically the design side and the university side. And so I struggled necessarily with the university side, and then I was good with the design side. So it was design part kept me going and slugging through the university part.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like maybe if the system was different, if things worked different, if accommodations were different, maybe you'd be a sign language interpreter today, right?
Yeah. Well, like, because of my working memory, it just was not a good fit. But yeah, it wasn't about the school. It was not a good fit because you have to keep all the characters in your head as you're coding them and then put them together. So yeah, I learned a lot about disability and like the community, learned a lot in that aspect, but was not a good fit for me. And I'm glad that after the first year I stopped.
Yeah. I mean, that's always an interesting sort of balancing act thing I think about a lot, right? Because there's a lot that goes into us as people with disabilities, learning our needs and learning what accommodations we need. But there's also a lot about like learning about ourselves, right? And sometimes we are more complex. And so I don't know. It's just interesting. I know, Nikki, you've talked about in the past kind of that journey that you went on of not even deciding to identify as a person with a disability, but just self-knowledge and knowing yourself. Was that a thing? It sounds like that was a thing that you had to do, Drew.
Yeah, because throughout school, the only focus on what I was not able to do, which was writing, reading, and they didn't even mention that I have strengths at all. Like, my perceptual organization is in the 99th percentile, and I didn't know that. When your whole life, you only get told what you're bad at, what you can't do, and you only notice the pain points, it's hard to notice when things go right. Because with design, it's easy to notice the bad things, but it's hard to notice the good design. So when everything's negative, it's hard to have self-confidence about what you're able to do. So it's like, it's still trying to rethink that I am really smart.
Before we continue this conversation, it's time to pause for just a minute for a word from our sponsor.
Hello, my name is Samia. I'm a full-time magnification or Zoom user. I am a member of Fable's community of accessibility testers. If you're listening to this podcast, you already know just how important it is to integrate the voices of persons with disability into every aspect of your product development journey. Fable can help you do that. From improving your team's accessibility, training with Fable Upskill, to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage, we can help you take the next step in building amazing websites and apps that are accessible and easy to use for everyone. To learn more, check out our website www.makeitfable.com and follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.
And we're back. Let's get right back to it.
It's really interesting hearing your journey, but what experience sort of shaped your perspective around disability?
I guess it's all of it, really. Like, it's growing up, struggling with school, and then, I guess, learning about accessibility and, like, learning about other people's needs. But, I can't think of a specific moment, like, when I understood myself. It's hard to understand, like, because of the complexity of trying to understand myself and my disability, it's hard to really understand my perspective of disability because I'm still trying to unpack that.
So it sounds like you're in the middle of shaping what your perspective of disability is based on your own personal experiences.
The other thing that's interesting to me is change. And it seems like you've been on a life journey, and sometimes even our own experiences of our disability can change, right? Is that something you've noticed and had to contend with?
Yeah, it's like as I discover different tools or like different things work and different things don't, it changes how I perceive myself. Mm-hmm. Like if I had text to speech in public school, I would have been much better off instead of where I was, because like there's one time when everyone was giving a test with like a few paragraphs in the front and questions on the back, and so I was reading it and it was like halfway through like the first paragraph and I hear someone else flip over their page. And then another person, and by the time everyone had finished, I'd only gotten like halfway through the reading. I had text to speech, I would be able to read it like through like twice the speed or more. And so I wouldn't have been at that disadvantage of trying to focus one while I was reading and struggling. So that both the dyslexia for reading and then the ADHD with all the noise around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then of course, on top of that, there's the daily variability, right? In a tiny way, I don't consider it a disability, but like I have a stomach condition and some days are great days. And some days you just have to recognize that you're lying in bed in pain, and some days your brain works and some days it doesn't. And you know, that can make things even more confusing. But that said, let's sort of move things forward. People are fascinating and we could talk about this stuff forever, but sort of moving down the timeline. So it seems like you kind of came to figure out what you needed and came to know your disability and yourself, and you've started sort of embracing that identity and that label and doing those kind of, you know, disclosures up front. And so what are the outcomes that you've experienced as you begin to talk about disability and embrace that more, and how has that been for you?
Definitely growing confidence, because it's a better understanding of what I'm good at and how it could be so much easier if things were set up differently. And also hearing other people's struggles and then trying to help them also navigate employment.
Yeah.
And it's like a frustration when you suddenly realize, man, things should be better and they're not, right? There can be some frustration there. And then I love what you said about helping others, because we don't do it alone and we aren't islands. And so I'd love to hear about kind of your experience with community. Who's your community? Did you find them or did you have to build them yourselves? And yeah, I mean, what kind of communities did you find? What kind of communities did you build? And how has that gone for you along the way?
Just all the different people that focus on accessibility on LinkedIn and hearing their struggles, hearing what has worked, and all the people with disabilities and also their struggles and what has worked and mostly what has not worked, and just feeling connected to everyone.
It seems like a lot of people have found their community through LinkedIn. A few of our guests have actually said this, that like their biggest sort of engagement or their conversations really happen on LinkedIn. Do you feel that is like the place where you have the biggest online sort of community or network?
It's hard to have more than one, like for me to focus on more than one social network. And because my struggle is focused around employment, that's where I've focused my energy. And it's where a lot of people who have the power to make the change are. So it's trying to connect with them.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like some people are sort of have that luxury of building the community where they want to be in a place that's great for them. And other people sort of have to go to where the community already is. And so what's your experience of doing that, of trying to build connection, of trying to connect with influential people? Is it a great experience? Are you loving every day and excited to do it, or has it been sort of more of an ongoing challenge for you?
Surprisingly, I was surprisingly good at it, whether it be, just like making comments about alt text and camel case hashtags on people's posts, and then starting conversations with that, and then like just building on that, or complimenting people when they have good alt text, and then just like expanding my understanding of different people's needs. Like using emojis as bullet points is bad for screen readers, but it's also helpful for other people, like people with autism. So it's a trying to find balance of that double-edged sword of accessibility. It's like not ignoring one community for the other. Because
That one's really hard for me because I love emojis and GIFs and stuff like that, but I don't like too much emotion. And I also really I'm dyslexic as well. So it's like really hard for me to like write with words. And I love to express myself with like be really difficult where I'm trying to be very like conscious of other people's experiences and make everything as inclusive as possible. But then really like, how do we balance that? It's so hard.
Right. And I mean, that's something that has played out a lot. For example, in the history of screen readers, right? Like emojis were seen as kind of a silly fad for a while, and nobody wanted to put in the work to make screen readers read them, right? And so how do we balance, when is it somebody's AT or when is it that a person with a disability needs to change, and when is it that the world needs to change? Can sometimes be a more difficult question than we think, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm really curious, Drew, what discoveries have surprised you on your journey?
I've had two people say I should write a book, and that surprised me, but also that it got to the point where I'm not scoffing at the idea anymore. Because, 5 years ago, if you told me that I would actually be considering writing something longer than a few paragraphs, I would be very surprised.
Interesting.
And just and the fact that I had the confidence to ask for a lot of random people on the internet to have informational interviews with me about design, and that a lot of directors and executives were actually willing to talk.
Mm-hmm. I think that's important for people to know that they can, like, people are nicer. Sometimes you'll get a lot of rejection, but sometimes, you'll get very surprised by the amount of people who are willing to, like, talk to you. You reached out to me on LinkedIn, and look, and now we're here.
Yeah, isn't it? I mean, these days, you can just email people or reach out to people and ask for a chat. And I think we've hit the point in tech now where the worst thing that's happened, they won't even say no. The worst thing that can happen is they just won't answer you, right? which can be anxiety of its own. It seems like from what you said, the in that you found is really around giving people practical things they can do, right? Like alt text and camel case hashtags and things like that. Like, did that surprise you that actually asking someone to do something like that rather than a kind of more theoretical ask would be more productive? Or like, how did you get to that place?
Well, because all text and things like that are the easiest ways to get, like, they're the simplest things for people to do. And if you can get them to kind of like switch that, then maybe you can get them to think about bigger ideas and bigger concepts.
Yeah, it's like exercise, right? If someone starts doing it for 3 minutes a day, then eventually they'll get to 30, but you can't ask them to start with 30. And I mean, that's such a great, I think, segue into kind of the next thing that we like to ask all of our guests about, which is, I mean, first of all, I hope that all of our listeners to this podcast are including alt text on their posts, but maybe they're not. But like, what are the things that people can do right now after this episode to start on that path towards inclusion and access and furthering the rights of people with disabilities, whether they're a person with a disability themselves or want to be an ally? What advice do you give people who come to you and just want to get started?
Listening is the big one, because if someone asks for accommodations, actually don't just question it, but actually like think about it, because an accommodation doesn't mean it's going to be easier for them, and it doesn't mean it's going to be an unfair advantage. It just means that they are going to be doing something differently. And if you want someone to get from point A to point B, you could have them to ride a bike, but that's not the only way to get to point A to point B. So if someone wasn't able to ride a bike and you rejected them because of that, but they can actually teleport from point A to point B, then you're missing out on a lot of opportunity. So
yeah, that's the key, isn't it? That accommodations, people think accommodations are going to be hard for them when really they're just going to be different for them, right? How do we break this narrative that like doing something differently somehow means it has to be hard?
It's also like, if in public school I was able to use text-to-speech and I was able to read the text 3 times faster, does that mean everyone has to read the text 3 times faster with text-to-speech? Or if I'm able to finish something in 3 minutes and everyone takes 9 minutes, does that mean they have to now finish it 3 minutes?
Yeah.
There's this false narrative, right? Of, oh, well, if someone does something really well, now they're going to raise the bar on all of us, right? It seems to come right out of capitalism. And maybe, I don't know if you've experienced this, Drew, but maybe we as people with disabilities can do that to each other sometimes, right? Oh, if he's really good at doing this, then I'm going to be expected to be really good at doing this. So like, I better like keep him from being really good at doing this, which is, you know, interesting the way we think about talent and accommodation sometimes. And it kind of makes me also think about when you're talking to people about kind of your disability and your needs, how do you get them to understand that, like, kind of the differences between equality and inclusion, and start striving for inclusion instead of maybe striving for equality?
I haven't had much experience, because with applying for jobs, you don't know if they're rejecting you because of your qualifications or because you're asking for accommodations. If you just hear nothing, you don't know why.
Yeah.
So it's hard. I haven't had an opportunity to have that conversation.
Mm.
So it's tricky, because
it's tricky. It's okay not to know. You know what I mean? Because I don't know necessarily either. But these are kind of the conversations. To close us off, is there anything that you would love to share that we didn't ask you about?
Disability is the most inclusive minority, and anyone can join at any time. So act accordingly.
True. This conversation was great, but all conversations, you know, they come to an end. But if people wanted to continue this conversation, or do you have anything you want to promote?
Yeah, it can be found on LinkedIn, or if something happens with LinkedIn, my website, which is drewharima.com.
Links will be in the show notes.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan. Edited and produced by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. Theme music is created by F.A. Ackman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram @DisabilityBandwidth or on our website at disabilitybandwidth.com.